The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to introduce our guests this evening. The Interim Director of Leslie Lohman Museum of Art, Laura Rykovich, is a fierce advocate for museums to be hubs of activism and care that foster a more engaged and informed public. The former director of the Queen's Museum, her 2018 resignation from that institution became one of the latest instances of politicized resignations amongst museum administrators across the U.S. A recipient of the Rockefeller Foundation Bellagio Fellowship, Rykovich lectures internationally, has created and implemented new museum preservation strategies, and is the author of the books At the Lightning Field and A Diary of Mysterious Difficulties. In her new book, Culture Strike, she offers context for historical and contemporary controversies, argues that ideological neutrality in museums is a myth, and outlines a plan for improving these institutions to better serve the public. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Seth Rodney, opinions editor and managing editor of the Sunday edition for Hyperallergic, author of The Personalization of the Museum Visit, and winner of the 2020 Rapkin Arts Journalism Prize. It's great to have you both with us. The screen is yours.
Thanks, Andy.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks very much for that introduction. I think we can dispense with the frivolities and just get into it. Is that all right, Laura?
Absolutely, Seth.
Okay, great. Great, fantastic. I'm going to ask you a somewhat impertinent initial question. Mm-hmm. I hope that's okay.
Totally okay.
Why is this book necessary? Culture Strike.
I think there's a massive struggle going on right now with what museums mean and what meaning they deliver to various publics. I think there are a lot of questions. I think everyone thinks that art is very powerful, but that the institutions that present the art are flawed, that maybe there are a number of people who question what meaning the art that's being presented in those institutions conveys to the public and why it's being chosen and how and by whom. Mm. But also, what do these institutions say to regular folks? Like, and how do they say it? And are they delivering, if they're public institutions in a kind of broader sense, are they delivering what the public desires? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the question that I found, or I guess the issue that I got wrapped up in my mind and in my out of my experience, mm-hmm. was that there's this very significant piece of the museum mm-hmm. that is both trusted on one level as a source of information, as a source of education, as a source of ideas, that's deeply trusted, right? And then on the other hand, the museum seems to be controlled by a very narrow segment of the population, an elite, if you will, a segment of the population that's of a certain race, of a certain class, of a certain demographic. Mm. And that wasn't necessarily servicing a wider public. And so there are these two kind of views of the museum that have to be negotiated all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write this book because I felt that I had some experiences being both inside the museum and inside many different cultural institutions, including those that produce public art, as well as museums with collections, that gave me a perspective that I could share about both how those institutions function and also what I see as the dysfunctions of those places. Mm-hmm. And I think why right now? Well, you know, I started this project 3 years ago, so it's been a while in the making. You know how books go. And of course, you know, I submitted the first draft of this book, you know, in March of last year, and then subsequently wrote an additional chapter with some reflections on the last 18 months. But I think that those urgencies that I came to this project with 3 years ago are probably magnified by what we've been through in the last 18 months, because I think that between social and racial justice protests and the COVID crisis and the economic crisis that's also ensued, I think that our divisions and our social and economic and environmental differences and the ways in which the world is dysfunctional is that much more, those differences are really, have been really heightened by the last 18 months. And so it feels like we're deeper into this, these questions. And I just, you know, I think that we need different ways to look at the problems, look at the challenges that we face as a larger society. And because I know the museum, and because I know that the museum and the cultural space so closely mirror the wealth inequities in society, the social dysfunctions of society, that my thought was, well, okay, if I can figure out how to make some headway, or if we can collectively figure out how to make some headway in our cultural universe, in our cultural institutions, maybe that's useful in the larger space.
So does it help, you think, that you have this kind of insider perspective and experience?
I think it only helps insofar as, you know, I know some of the answers to the questions that are, I think, frequently asked at the outset, you know, like, how does a board work? What does it mean to be a museum director? What are you actually deciding about? You know, what does it mean to build a budget? Like, what does the budget of a museum look like? Why is it so expensive to run? You know, how much money do you spend on, you know, exhibitions or public programs or educational programs? Like,
which is another way of basically asking you what your priorities are.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think exactly. Like, we're, well, and also there are things that you have to spend money on whether you want to or not. And, you know, whether, you know, I think, you know, every business and nonprofit in the United States should be, you know, at the doors of Congress every day fighting for single payer healthcare because of the insane increases in health insurance that get visited upon all of our budgets from year to year. I mean, there was a period of time when I worked at DIA where it was literally 18 to 20% increase year over year.
Wow.
And so, you know, the realities of that scale of crazy is just, you know, to something that is a human right that we should all have access to, like, without question, is just daunting, you know, from a material aspect of, like, I have to devote this sick amount of money in my budget every year to health insurance, and I want to do what's best for my team because everybody needs good health insurance.
Right.
And then, you know, you get hit with this private insurance company. So, you know, that is just like a tiny sliver of the reality, I think, that helps, you know, and then also just in terms of, you know, where my thinking comes from on, you know, the analysis piece. Mm-hmm. It's like, for example, you know, I think that, you know, in thinking about what we can do better, mm-hmm. the kind of proposals for change, even just in the simple dumb things of, like, make sure that there is a friggin' pay range on every job description that's posted. You know, just there are some dumb, like I call them dumb ideas because they're not like super special and brilliant and a million people have had them, but like everybody can implement it. Like those are no brainers. Just do it. But it's a question of getting inside of these systems that are geared for a certain type of success, right? So it's like, you know, I actually have had conversations with previous human resources colleagues who said to me, well, that's just not done. It's not a best practice. It's like, well, let's look at what we're calling best practices then, because to me, it's a big waste of time to bring somebody in and have a million interviews. It's a waste of their time. It's a waste of our time. If there's no way they're going to be able to accept the salary range that we're imagining for this position.
No, that's right. And that actually shows a decent amount of respect to the person who is applying for the job, who you may very much want on staff, but doesn't have the sort of resources that would allow them to be profligate with spending their time and attention and various funds for copying, whatever, on making that application. So that's actually a very, the words that's coming to mind is generous, but it's a tick below generous. It's just respectful. It's basic.
That's basic. Like, I'm not going to waste your time.
Right.
You know, that goes hand in hand with saying that all of the salaries in museums need to be better.
No, that's exactly right. No, and they need to
I mean, I don't mean to say like, you know, it's okay to have a crap salary.
No,
if you have to have a meh salary, make sure you put it out there, right?
Right, for sure. And I think people know that about you before even reading your book. I want to get into some nitty gritty stuff.
Let's do it.
Because I read your book and you can see I highlighted some passages that were quite meaningful to me. I'm going to take a different tact. I did listen in to your talk with Aruna D'Souza and Ken Chen and I'm blanking on the last person's name.
Kelly Morgan.
Thank you. The other week. And having had the experience of that, I want to take a very sort of granular approach to asking some questions about the book, which occurred to me. You say on page 24, I'm going to quote, the Enlightenment period with its commitments to individualism, reason, and the separation of church and state is perhaps equal only to modernism in its impact on museums and cultural institutions. In fact, the Enlightenment idea of universal man and subsequent reification via modernism lies at the core of the emergence of the myth of neutrality in museums. Okay, so you know, neutrality in museums is a central theme to your book. We know that. We who have read the book. But I want to get at this modernism thing. It's equal. You say that the Enlightenment period is equal only to modernism and its impact on museums and cultural institutions. What is the impact that modernism has had on these museums and cultural institutions? How do you see, first of all, before we should define our terms.
Yes.
Please tell us what you believe modernism to be and then how that's impacted our cultural institutions.
Well, I think modernism in the context of my book is, I talk about modernism as a kind of container for a distillation of capitalism and individualism in the modern period, right?
Okay.
So in the sense of the reification of the individual, the confirmation of the genius, particularly in the art context, the genius artist, the individual as the prime mover and shaker of society, right?
Okay.
So we can go through, let's get specific here because I think this is a really important aspect of both the book and my thinking just in general with what's wrong with society right now, but as reflected particularly in the museum. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about money, Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about money. So, you know, the individual donor, the major philanthropists, these are all like gifts, seen as gifts mm-hmm. to society, right? Mm-hmm. And in a sense, you know, it's us, the public, all of us, who've given the right to the wealthy person to make the donation, mm. as opposed to there being a tax on their wealth, mm-hmm. which the public then, through their elected officials, gets mm. to determine what it's used for. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, my advocacy around the public mm-hmm. is to reclaim that aspect of our power, our collective power as mm-hmm. a public mm-hmm. to say, no, we actually want some of that decision-making power back. And if you look at the taxation rates, even just of the Reagan era, if
we there were 35%.
Yeah, if we were at those taxation rates, 33 to 35% mm-hmm. for the mm-hmm. super wealthy, different zone. Like mm-hmm. we're just in a totally different zone from a public works perspective, from an infrastructure perspective. And what's important there, and I'll get back to modernism in a second, but like, mm-hmm. but what's important there is that culture needs to be re-understood in all of our imaginations as a crucial infrastructure in the United mm. States. Mm. And therefore has to be met with the resources that other infrastructures are met with. Mm-hmm. Like, I want culture to be part of the annual transportation bill, because that's about infrastructure, right?
Right.
Like, I want a national ministry of culture.
Right.
Because we need to have ultimately a national conversation about what culture means so mm-hmm. that we can demand a rebalancing of the what is delivered to publics mm-hmm. through culture mm-hmm. based on the desires of the public and not just this kind of subset of wealthy individuals who support the arts. And there's nothing wrong with those people. They just mm-hmm. have a very particular point of view. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it's just a very specific thing. And mm-hmm. so to see more of us reflected in those cultural spaces, we need the public to be supporting those cultural institutions in a more visible way, more than just giving the tax write-off.
Yeah, I keep thinking about this story, and I actually have been kind of lazy and I haven't actually looked it up, but there's a story of a town. I want to say it was they pooled their resources and bought a football team. I think it was the Green Bay Packers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. They got together and they said, no, we're not going to let whomever, the oligarch, be the person who like buys this team and then owns the resources and then does just sleight of hand mm-hmm. Shenanigans to get the city to pay for a huge stadium. They said, no, we're going to actually do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And they did. And I keep wondering about that as a model for ownership of essentially cultural institutions. I keep wondering why that can't be repeated. So I want to nail down a couple of things that you kind of said, and maybe I can say them more a little bit more explicitly.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about when you talk about modernism, you're talking about please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Is an ideological construct that is inflected by a particular set of historical developments. So accretion of money to a particular class. You mentioned in your book, you quote, I think it's Ocasio-Cortez, who says that every billionaire is a policy failure. So so this ideological construct, you're calling modernism, is inflected by this development of this billionaire class, donor class, as far as museums are concerned, donor class, wealthy individuals, and it's inflected by this mythos of the genius artist, genius philanthropist, genius entrepreneur, genius curator, genius individual. And it always comes down to that sort of that individual sort of rising above the collective and sort of leading the way out of the dark wilderness. And this amalgam of ideas, this ideological construct, has something to do, you're saying, with how the museum gets structured in the modern realm. Because of this, if I follow the trail of breadcrumbs, museums tend to be hierarchical.
Yes, and not only hierarchical, because this is, I think, an important piece of the dysfunction, is that it is part of the job, for example, of the museum director, because I've stood in those shoes, right? Mm-hmm. So part of my job was to literally be that individual, that like genius individual.
Yeah, the hero.
Perform that role, to raise the money, because I had to attract the people who would say, ooh, she's one of those. Mm-hmm. She's one of those. Mm-hmm. And
we should give her money.
Yeah, because what I do as a philanthropist is I support the brilliant people who do good work.
Right.
I'm not saying I'm brilliant. I'm just saying I had to.
No, I get it. You had to play that role.
As such.
Yeah, so that
I could play the game, right?
Yeah.
So, and what I also had to do was to be able, I had to translate this profoundly collective enterprise that was the museum into individual successes.
Right.
Because that is what is valued by society.
Right.
And I think that is like the ultimate Marlboro man bullshit.
Right.
You know, that like I'm standing on the edge of a horse. I mean, an edge of a cliff on a horse, you know, probably I should have a penis too, but you know, whatever, we'll ignore the gender thing for a minute. But like, I'm sitting there and like looking out into the sunset, you know, like this is the image that people want to buy into, whether you're talking about an entrepreneur or, you know, and so to me, this is the precise collision of modernism and capitalism in the cultural realm. It's like, okay, this is what we need of our leadership, because that's where we're going to see the vision, vision, singular.
Right.
So it's very difficult to even begin to see those things. Never mind imagine what we would do alternatively.
Otherwise. So I used to say to people, there was a point at which I dreamt of working in a museum. And this is, I think I disabused of this idea at some point working on the PhD. but before I did, I did work in museums as a docent. Museum of Latin American Art, actually, in Long Beach, California. But after working on the PhD, I definitely lost the taste for that. And what I used to say to people when they'd ask me why, is I'd say, I figured out that most museums are fiefdoms. And everyone is sort of, every lord and lady sort of in service as a vassal to the, like, to the king. And you sort of report to the king and say, you know, my liege, we provided, you know, this and this to the public. Like, and I'm not at all interested in that, at all. And I don't think that you are either. I'm going to ask another question, if I may.
Go ahead.
Okay, so on page 28, you say that, I'm going to continue with this sort of Enlightenment modernism theme. You say that that, as John Simmons points out in his extensive history of museums, Peel, quote, wholeheartedly embraced the Enlightenment ideals of intellectual freedom and tolerance. And it occurred to me that you might not think that these are actually Enlightenment ideals. And please tell me whether you do or not. But also, on the tail end of that, are there any Enlightenment ideals that we can see in the current iteration of the public museum that we should hold on to?
Right. Well, tolerance is a difficult one for me.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm obvi. But, yeah. you know, what was the first one? Sorry.
Freedom.
Freedom. Okay. Phil, freedom. Freedom. I'm totally into. So I think, but I think that what perhaps the Enlightenment thinkers were imagining when that particular freedom was conditioned upon the oppression and colonization of other people. And so, you know, for me, enlightenment freedom is different from, I think, the freedom and liberation struggles that that activists and have been fighting for ages. And because it's tuned not to the freedom of a small group of people to do whatever they want, with only through the oppression of others, but rather through an ideology of emancipation, of mutual emancipation. And so I think that's the part of the Enlightenment piece that's really a problem for me, is that those rights of the Enlightenment are not extended to literally all people. They are only extended to certain people. And I think once you stop fitting that definition of what that club was meant to represent, you weren't entitled to those rights. So, you know, so that's where I falter with the Enlightenment, and that the exclusions are just so great. It's like freedom. Yes. Awesome. Let's hold on to that for dear life.
But asterisk.
But asterisk, actually, right. Like, not that specific freedom, because that specific freedom was meant for like rich white men of a certain class, of a certain educational background, of a certain ilk. And, you know, that's all well and good, but can't we all have that without, you know, without having to, or can we invent a different way of having that so that it doesn't rely upon slavery and colonization and extraction and, you know, basically killing the planet? Like, are there other ways that mutual liberation can be had? And can that be something that we can model in cultural space? I mean, those are the big questions, right?
Right. So are there any Enlightenment ideals that you see showing up in our current museums?
Oh, do I see them showing up? Hell yeah. You know, I think the study of the past is like a really specific Enlightenment ideal. It's just that it's a very filtered past. It's what is in service of the status quo. And I think part of our beautiful challenge right now is to imagine the types of storytelling that we can and should be doing that don't necessarily address those other long persistent you know, stories. What has been left out because of the blindness of the bias of the museum? What richnesses can we then further accrete into this space, perhaps, you know? And I guess, you know, I haven't answered the question for myself, whether I think there is, you know, whether, I mean, I do, yes, I actually have. I mean, come on, I have. Sorry, I'm having a little conversation with myself for a second here, because—
Please carry on.
You know, I do think that the museum has a place. You know, I'm not one of, you know, Aruna and I, we were talking, and she and Kelly were both like, well, we just need to burn it down. And, you know, and I actually don't believe that.
I know you don't.
I don't believe that. Right. That's part of why I wrote this book. I think that the museum has had too many resources, intellectual, human, knowledge resources poured into it to just give up on it, right? And I think it exists in so many different forms.
Right.
That I think that it's not just salvageable, it's like essential, I guess.
I would agree with that. And you and I have talked about this before. You know, I've said in my book that I fundamentally believe that museums are one of the few key institutions. There are not that many. I mean, public parks, maybe another, libraries, maybe. Libraries, definitely. But museums are one of the few places where we subject personal experience to public debate, where we come together, not because we are members of the same family and not because we work together. Literally, we come together in a civic space, which really only exists in the spaces that cultural institutions make for that to exist, right? Like we come together, how do a group of strangers come to spend time with each other and lessen the distance between them as strangers? And museums are key to that, I would argue, until my dying day.
Yes.
I do want to get to another question. Page 92. And this is going to be another irreverent one. So
good, go for it.
Okay, great. So you say in talking about the sort of ways that institutions ham-fistedly deal with protests, you say, so perhaps insiders, art workers, directors, board members, public relations firms, and staff should read and respond to protests differently and see it as a useful mirror for collective self-reflection. Mm-hmm. Okay. Real talk. Would you say the same thing to the Catholic League and Rudolph Giuliani when they were protesting the Chris O'Feely show at the Brooklyn Museum?
Oh, good question. That's a good question. Yeah, I think that protest is really important. I think it teaches us something about who we are and what we want out of whatever institution it is, whether we're on the receiving end or on the giving end, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, I think that the Giuliani situation, I think, probably sharpened a lot of museum workers, or I would imagine that it did. It did to me as a cultural worker. I wasn't working in a museum then, but it sharpened my ideas about what interference looks like, what censorship looked like. So, you know, in a sense, that was a form of radical care. It was like showing to me what that actually meant. It doesn't necessarily rely, my recommendation doesn't rely on it being like a positive influence, right? It can sharpen your notions of the things you want to listen more closely to. But I think in the case of the more recent wave of protests, where the protests were geared from a social justice angle, rather than an ideological one, which the Giuliani ones were decidedly ideological in there.
I would argue, Laura, that social justice concerns are just as ideological as anything else.
Yeah, okay, you're right. That was maybe I used the wrong word there. I agree with you. But I think that there is there's a reality that I think is based a historical reality in the kind of social justice concerns around racism, around any form of bias in relation to identity that I think is really important to hear. And, you know, I think from being inside of cultural spaces, you know, there are many people inside of cultural organizations who are part of the protests also. Like, this is not a mutually exclusive group. The Venn diagram is overlapping, right? But there are also people who aren't, and they're completely outside of that conversation. And I think, you know, in a similar way that you pointed out that, you know, in say the galleries, you might have a meeting of people who are strangers and who might not have ever met otherwise. I think on staffs of museums, especially really large museums where you have several hundred people working, you probably have people who would never have encountered one another. It's not like they're all necessarily art lovers or whatever. I worked at the Guggenheim for 3 months. There were not necessarily all, you know, people who love to look at art. There were people who had just a job and that was their job. They worked at the Guggenheim, you know? So just to say, like, the assumption that there is uniformity on the interior of a cultural space also is erroneous. And I think that subtlety is really important in negotiating both what's happening inside and what's happening outside. And I guess my feeling is that too many cultural spaces, especially when confronted with these moments of, you know, whether it's controversy or crisis, wherever they may be framing it, because everybody feels precarious. I've worked in cultural institutions that have like gobs of money compared to others, and everyone still feels precarious, I can tell you. So, and that condition is permanent. Because at the end of the day, you have to raise all of your money every year, unless you are lucky enough to have an endowment, in which case that throws off maybe, if you're lucky, 10%, 5%, 20%. So anyway, I just feel like that piece of the puzzle is really important, that when the controversy strikes, that the first response isn't circle the wagons, as you know, that there is this kind of pause. And this is where I get into this idea of slowing down, because it's nerve-wracking. I've been there. It's like terrifying, because you know how hard you and your whole team are working to produce the cool stuff that you're producing for the public. And it's all done, you know, very high, you know, in a very generously minded way. So you're terrified, but at the same time, like, to resist in that moment, blocking, just take a step back and be like, what can I hear out of this? How can we hear this? How can we hear it and process it in a way that isn't going to diminish anyone? It's not about diminishing the protest or diminishing the work, but just to hear what's actually being said. Because I think, you know, that operates on a number of different levels. And as I talk about in the book, some of the most, you know, radical changes that have been happening in recent years, for example, with Warren Kanders at the Whitney, happened not because there was one particular group protesting. It happened because there were staffers who wrote a really important letter, and there were external protesters. There was really good, you know, reporting.
By Hyperallergic.
Like there were all these different layers, and then the artists also played a role both in the protest, but also in demanding that their work be withdrawn from the exhibition. So you had this kind of constellation of things that were both coordinated and not coordinated. I think that's also important. You know, it's not always plannable, right?
Right.
Stage making. And so I think, I mean, to your question, I think you're right. It's like, I mean, I'm gripping onto a very slippery slope, as it were, the slippery slopes of all of this conversation. But I do think that there's like listening to be done when you have these moments of crisis and controversy, either to sharpen your resolve to resist whatever it is that's being demanded, or to perhaps make you more open to understanding what the institution could potentially be doing better.
That's that's a very thoughtful response. I am tempted to ask you one more thing. I've just been given the sign in the chat that we should be moving on to questions from the audience. There are six so far, and they all look rather substantial, or I should say each looks rather substantial. But I can do this with you, Laura? Laura, can I ask you to just answer this one last question for me in like a minute and 30 seconds, if you can?
I'll go fast.
Okay. What do museums do really well?
Well, that's a tough question. Museums do research really well. Museums do education work really well.
I concur.
I think museums also can organize the heck out of something. Like, you know, they know how to use their infrastructure to make stuff happen. And to that point, I think that's where museums can be really useful, is because they know how to make stuff happen. They can realize something. They can take something from an idea to materializing it in space. And I think that that's what's really, really substantially important about the infrastructure piece.
Fantastic. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to start to take questions from our audience. Thank you, audience, for listening in. Thank you for engaging and participating in this kind of way, in this kind of muscular way. Tom Richardson asks, can you talk about how you fell in love with museums and why you wanted to be part of one? And does that initial spark still live in you, or have you become cynical or more hopeful about the museum and your place in it? Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. I and Seth for reading that. So I fell in love with museums because my parents, I grew up at partially in the suburbs of New York City, and you know, usually once or twice a year we would, you know, drive into the cloisters around Christmas time, and just remembering like driving through the ramparts at Fort Tryon Park and and the kind of magic of being there, or, you know, zipping up those escalators at MoMA. I remember Black, White and Red, like it's just like those, the old MoMA escalators going from design to the Surrealist galleries. Those were always my favorite. You know, I think there's this kind of push and pull, and it's interesting because of this work that I've been doing with the Brooklyn Public Library around the art and society census work that we've been doing, and kind of hearing from folks like what they appreciate about museums. And I think for me, there's this kind of double-sided coin thing that happens with museums, where it's like that moment of completely, I did not expect to see that, or what the heck is that? That complete moment of like wonder and like, what the hell? Combined with some other times, that moment of, wow, that reflects my experience in the world, you know? And I think those two things, whether one is challenging and one is more, you know, they can each operate in their own ways, in very challenging ways or very uplifting ways, or, you know, joyous ways and whatever, or really difficult ways of confronting realities. But I think the fact that museums and cultural spaces can evoke both of those things for me is magic. Like, to me, sure. So that's, I would say that's my answer to that question.
That's a very good answer. Dana Marks asks, what are some ideas that you have read or read about that can be implemented to effect radical equality of the viewer? And I'm thinking of your interview here with Maya Chow. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Look at art, get paid in Hyperallergic.
Okay, well, first of all, that project, Look at Art, Get Paid, is an amazing, incredible project that is ongoing in Massachusetts, and they continue to do work in other cultural institutions. I know that things got a little wobbly with COVID, but I believe that is all, you know, back on track, or re-emergingly on track. But that project is really brilliant, in part because it actually seeks the advice. Oh, so let me say what it is. Look at Art, Get Paid was a project that was initiated by two students at Brown, in collaboration with the RISD Museum of Art. And they brought regular folks into the museum through advertisements in neighborhoods around Providence, inviting regular folks to get paid to look at look at art and look at the museum and provide feedback about what they saw. And to me, what was important about that is that the fundamentally important piece of that project was actually acknowledging the knowledges and the thinking of the public. Cultural institutions are trained as educators, right? The whole reason that the museum evolved in the United States the way that it did was largely as an educational component of the national project of building the nation, right? And so their museums in the United States take their educational work very seriously, perhaps to a point where they forget that their audiences actually have vast knowledges to contribute as well. And so in their attempts to constantly be broadcasting information and knowledge, there's been a kind of, in some cases and in some circumstances, there is less exchange with the public. Mm-hmm. And so what I thought was really important to look at about Look at Art Get Paid was its kind of appreciation of that knowledge. And I think, you know, I think a lot of education departments across the United States have been quite focused on this exchange of knowledge for a very long time. This is not claiming some kind of, but I think that if more of that style of communication rather than this broadcast style of communication,
and the transmission model,
rather than this just transmission, this one way channel radio thing, mm-hmm. if it could be two way radio, mm-hmm. I think that might change certain people's relationship to that educational, that kind of very particular broadcasty educational vibe. So I think to radically reimagine what that relationship is with the public, you have to radically reimagine how you're communicating, how your publics are communicating with you and as an institution and vice versa.
Very, very insightful. Jesse Kaplan asks, what three things can museums, libraries, and cultural institutions do right now to move forward more equitably? This is a great discussion. Thanks so much. I think you just kind of answered that.
Yeah, but I want to say one more thing.
Okay.
There's another thing. Slowing down, radically slowing down. I think cultural spaces are producing way too much in way too short a period of time. And what I really think is that slowing down allows all of us to take a little bit more time to think and to, more importantly, bring more people into the conversation. Like this whole idea of like who decides, that's very narrow in part because of the timelines that we just put on stuff. It's like, well, we have to decide tomorrow, so I'll just be the decider, you know. But maybe Seth, you and I should have lunch tomorrow and really talk it through, because maybe that gets to a better decision.
Right.
And I don't believe in this thing that committees baked out bad decisions. I think that you actually have to listen to what people are saying and then collectively come up with decision making. I'm not saying that every exhibition needs to be curated by like in that mode, but I'm just saying like there are ways to think before you act that where a collective discussion is going to really add value. So I just want to add that slowing down.
Yes. And I think that that's, I'm glad that you did. Rachel Duplessis is posing a question. Assuming that universities are a crucial part of the cultural infrastructure, are there any lessons from the way universities reconfigured fields and could do so again, such as Black or racial studies, gender studies, etc.? That is, these fields were reconfigured often as studies. So is there a lesson, and she puts lesson in quotes, for museums about, this is a well-chosen word, sclerotic departments or intellectual divisions that should be made new or renewed?
Well, I think I think that that's an important lesson. And I think that it exists in a slightly different form, right? Mm-hmm. I think it exists in the form of the culturally specific institution. Leslie Lohman being a queer art museum, the Studio Museum in Harlem. I think culturally specific organizations perform, I think, that function that I'm sorry, I forgot the person's name because it just
Rachel Duplessis. That's okay.
That yes. Rachel brought up, you know, and I think that that's really important. I think, I think universal museums are much tougher nuts to crack. I think there's a whole kind of a different mode of thinking. And I think that a lot more work has to be done on the Universal Museum because I think that's a much more difficult ball of wax. Even the fact that I'm calling it the Universal Museum is really a problem.
Yeah, you mean Universal Survey Museum, essentially.
The Survey Museum, like which the is, Met,
which is,
right.
or, which is know, modeled like, on the Louvre.
Right, which are all coming out of this like grand European tradition of capturing the cultures of the planet in one building. So obviously there are problems with that, especially when you have looted art. I mean, there we could spend hours, but just to say, like, I think that the rethinking and the kind of delving more deeply, I think it comes from this desire to tell more stories, right? Mm-hmm. That the stories that have been allowed have been the stories that reinforce the status quo. So mm-hmm. how do we make more space in our cultural spaces to tell the stories that have not been allowed, right? And mm-hmm. how do we do that in a capable and thoughtful way, mm-hmm. Not in a knee-jerk way, right? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. James Dunbar has the next to last question, the penultimate question. Museums have been sites of protest and occupation due to their commodification and production of art for an elite art market only available to the ultra wealthy. Okay, that's not the question part yet. That's just an assertion, but okay, we're with you. Can museums be a site of institutional critique which situates the production for the market and the hyper-commodification of art while also expanding the discussion to those beyond the museum goer? I'm gonna just jump in here a little bit, Laura, if you don't mind, and say, I'm not sure that museums need to be a site of institutional critique because they've already kind of figured out how to absorb institutional critique.
That's exactly what I was going to say is right. that, you know, a prime example of that, actually, we can talk about Warren Kanders again, is the piece that Forensic Architecture made with Laura Poitras and Praxis Films for the biennial, the so-called tear gas biennial. Mm. And, you know, that was an in-depth dismantling or investigation into Warren Kander's business of supplying tear gas across the world, really, but particularly in Ferguson at the border, where it was used against asylum seekers in the United States and in Palestine. And I think, you know, I think that the way, I mean, I think that that project, I love Forensic Architecture and what they do. I think they have a brilliant art practice. And I think situating that in the midst of the biennial did something. It did something very specific. Mm-hmm. First of all, it functioned as a film that was educational, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It also functioned to disrupt the kind of clean narrative of the supporter of the museum, you know, existing in the same plane as this art object that was also disruptive to his the art object was itself disruptive to the trustees' narrative of their support of the museum, right?
Precisely.
And what that was meant to do from a
right.
From a structural perspective. And then it also triggered the looking around at what structures underlay the museum. Mm-hmm. But it also said, well, the museum is after all showing it, so maybe it's okay. You know, so maybe it all kind of works out in the end because they're
precisely
being self-critical.
Right.
And I think that the where that gets picked up again is when the staff writes the letter and when the protests happen and when all of these other things get layered on top of a gesture, a artwork being included in a biennial, mm-hmm. because that was a brave curatorial decision to make, to go to the director of the museum and be like, hey, this is the work we're putting in for Forensic Architecture. And then the director had to deal with that however he did. Mm-hmm. And I am certain that was not a happy conversation with Warren Kanders about that work. I'm sure that he protested to its inclusion, but on a certain level, here's where the museum can claim neutrality where it maybe shouldn't, where as the director, if I were the director of the Whitney, I could say, well, you know, Mr. Sanders, Kanders, you know, we have to respect the freedom of speech of the artist. You know, this is what they're thinking. It's not necessarily the opinion of the museum.
And the freedom of speech, essentially, of the curators, because they're the ones who are saying we're selecting this work because we think it is
it's important. Significant work of American art. And our job as the curators of the biennial are to put important works of American art in the museum, and this is our job, right?
Precisely, precisely.
But it is not necessarily a reflection of what we personally think or what the museum judges to your company called Safariland. You know, we don't necessarily, you know, have that judgment. And look, I have no idea what the conversation actually was, but I've definitely been tempted to use that excuse when I've had a wealthy individual who supported the institution that I was working for object to something that we were showing. Well, you know, but it's actually not a good way out. It's actually not. You need to do the work of saying, as a leader of the institution, actually, this is important work because, yes, it's an important work of American art, and that's what the point of the biennial is, and that's why we're showing it. But it's also an important reflection of what reality is. You know? And to have that tough conversation. I mean, I think that, you know, as museum directors, we don't necessarily get off the hook for that, even though it can be really difficult and we may, you know, endanger potentially losing a donor over it, you know?
Well, I could totally see a donor pushing back saying, well, what are museums, why are museums suddenly all that invested in reality? In fact, like the history of mark making and the related disciplines, anything that we call the arts really has more to do with our imaginative capacities, our ability to dream, to move beyond our just, in some cases, ugly, just brutish reality.
But I think it also is equally important, going back to the two sides of the coin that I fell in love with, of seeing our realities reflected in cultural space. And I think that will forever be a part of what cultural space does, is that it reflects our individual or collective realities, and whether that then inspires work like the Surrealists or a work of great imagination that brings us into a nightmare zone or a joyous zone or whatever that is. I think both exist simultaneously, and that confronting those realities through art is a very important part of collective life. I mean, understanding, or even, you know, because all of our realities obviously are not the same. And so, you know, how that gets negotiated, as you were saying in the beginning, between strangers in a public space, not an unpoliced public space, but a public space nonetheless, in that civic space, we have to negotiate that space together. And so how we do that in relationship to what that work is telling us about my reality or your reality or somebody else's reality, I think that that is a prime location for what museum work needs to address.
For sure. And we are in agreement on that. There's one last question. I'm going to ask you again, Laura, if you don't mind, to be rather succinct in your response, because we've got we actually have 0 minutes left. But I want to honor Bonnie Harper Zedek's question, which is, what kind of museums do we need that you don't presently see?
Oh boy. I think that I want to see more slow museums that really take care for the people who work in them, for the people who make the culture that's being shown in them, and for the people who visit them. Care for those existences in a really profound way. And I don't know what that means or what that necessarily looks like. And I think certain institutions are doing it beautifully. You know, a lot of smaller institutions that I love. And also some that aren't institutions even. We were just talking about the Sugar Hill Ice Cream Shop in Harlem, which is an ice cream shop, but really is doing amazing cultural work. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be invented, and
for sure.
We're just at a lucky moment right now where we get to try everything because there's so much that's messed up.
That's right. We're kind of clawing our way towards clarity maybe an inch at a time. Thank you, Laura. Thank you to Andy Cahan from the Philadelphia Free Library. And thanks to Julia Judge, Verso Books, who helped to put this event together and put Laura and I in conversation. And thanks for all our listeners. We really appreciate you being as engaged as you have been clearly in this conversation. And of course, thank you, Laura, for being who you are. And I'm Ben Sefrani. It's been my distinct pleasure to talk with you tonight. Good night.
Thank you so much, Seth. It's been, as always, such a pleasure to hang out, spend time, and share ideas.
Okay.
Thank you, Free Library. Thank Bye. You, everybody. Great to hang out together.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.